We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Everybody associates 40 time with being a deep threat, right? But Mike Evans has been one of the best deep threats in the NFL for his entire career for a guy that hasn't ever, you know, had blazing straight line speed. There are plenty of receivers in the NFL faster than Mike Evans, but he's got size. He's got the ability to run and open up with that long stride and still take the top off any defense in the NFL.
It's February 2014 at the NFL Combine. This is Remember That Game, the podcast about sporting events that take you on a journey and maybe chart the path of the zeitgeist. I'm your host, Thomas Emmerich, and my guest is Sam Monson, lead NFL analyst at Pro Football Focus and co-host of the PFF NFL show. Sam, I know you recently got back from the Combine in Indianapolis. What strikes you most when thinking about the conventional wisdom at the 14 Combine and how it's changed from 10 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, it's evolved and it's become a kind of different event from what it was 10 years ago. Certainly, the Combine has now, I think, become almost a couple of different events in one. It's always been a little bit like that, but it was in a much shorter time scale. You know, there's the team behind the scenes element of the Combine, which is a big part of it and tends to happen earlier in the week. And then there's obviously the thing that everybody knows the Combine for, the workouts and the media stuff and all that kind of thing. And that happens later in the week. So for PFF, it's always been, we got there early because the Combine is where we have our basic feedback sessions from all 32 teams that are now team customers. So we have a whole collection of guys that are set up at the JW Marriott there, which is one of the big hotels where half the people in Indy are staying, with a kind of conference room there. And it's just a constant revolving door of meetings for all 32 NFL teams. You know, what did you like? What didn't you like? What would you like to see added? All those kinds of things. And then there's the media side of things. And now that takes place, you know, over in the convention center towards almost at the very edge of the stadium. It was a while where Radio Row just kind of took place, I think, like in the foyer of Lucas Oil Stadium rather than all the way back at the convention center. Then it was slightly different people, or slightly different places rather. And that takes place at a different point in the week. It takes place later on. You know, it's sort of a day ahead of when the workouts happen. They roll in, they do the media interviews and all those kinds of things. So it's kind of two separate events, but where it's changing is that now media has access to the actual workouts. You know, they're allowing people in Lucas Oil Stadium to watch the workouts and those kinds of things. So whereas before, there was really no purpose in being in Indianapolis after like Thursday, everyone was out of there. Now you can be there through the weekend and still make sense. So it's almost becoming like a 10-day event as opposed to sort of half a week, either at the start of the second half.
The week kicked off with Pittsburgh Panther, Aaron Donald. I imagine one thing on your mind walking through downtown Indy back that morning was whether he would check those boxes.
Yeah, I mean, Donald was obviously a fascinating character back in his draft because he's the classic outlier from a size perspective, but had incredible tape, incredible production. 2014 was the last draft that we didn't have we didn't have PFF data on any of these guys. So we hadn't started doing college yet. The 2014 season was the first season of college data that we were going to have. So it was the following draft was the first one where we had this whole raft of PFF data on guys. So we're back basically doing the same way everybody else does, which is saying, all right, this guy's had great production. We love the tape. But clearly he's a massive size outlier, 285 pounds, at a position where even back then, I think there was a size difference. You know, guys like the sort of standards at three technique at that point were guys like Kevin Williams, who was, you know, 300, I think listed at 308 pounds, but was probably more like 315. And then Aaron Donald comes along and you're like, you know, can he get that done at the next level? The workout numbers were crazy, and the tape was crazy, and ultimately he still ended up sliding all the way to 13. And I think that's one of those where with hindsight, you look back and you say, we should have been pushing that harder, right? The question of how high you can draft the guy whose tape is insane, whose athleticism is insane, but doesn't tick all of our nice cookie cutter boxes in terms of size and measurables and prototypical numbers that we want to see.
I imagine it paves the way a little bit. Undersized defensive tackles with bursts like him. Would John Randall have actually been drafted in say 2017?
I think he'd have been drafted. I think he still would have been probably, like, he wouldn't have been a first round guy, I don't think. I mean, you know, who knows what John Randall's college tape looked like, right? I have no earthly idea. But assuming John Randall was the same guy in college as he was in the NFL, just at a lower level, and, you know, because of his size, he was overlooked, I think he would get drafted now. I think the whole process of scouting, it has improved. It's still a hit and miss prospect, but I think it's much more difficult now to fall completely under the radar. Like, if you are a really talented player, generally speaking, teams are going to know about you. Teams are going to find you. And even if you slip now out of the draft, you know, it's not like it was when there were 10, 12 rounds of the draft. There's only seven. And that is a finite number of guys, right? It's under 300 players a year coming into the NFL. So you can still go undrafted and teams think you're a good player. But I think if the idea that a guy like John Randall, just because he's undersized, would completely fall out of a draft and completely be off everybody's radar, I think now would probably not be the case.
Near the top at receiver, Mike Evans runs slower than 4.5, but has a lot of the size and college tape you want. Odell Beckham, a little smaller, great 10-yard split. At the time, most of the receivers near the top of the receiving yardage, you know, 2013 coming in this 2014 combine, they're big guys. Most of them with speed, like Calvin Johnson. Antonio Brown, maybe his first year topping 100 catches, so, but surrounded by much bigger receivers. Where were you in that tug of war between the traditional big receiver and the small speed receiver back there in 2014 at the combine?
Yeah, I mean, Mike Evans is another interesting example of how everybody associates 40 time with being a deep threat, right? But Mike Evans has been one of the best deep threats in the NFL for his entire career for a guy that hasn't ever, you know, had blazing straight line speed. There are plenty of receivers in the NFL faster than Mike Evans, but he's got size. He's got the ability to run and open up with that long stride and still take the top off any defense in the NFL. I think generally speaking, I don't think it's a big difference. I don't think it's a big differentiator size wise when it comes to wide receiver. Now, if you have two players and all things are equal, then take the guy that's got rare physical traits or size. You know, Randy Moss, the fact that he was sort of 6'4 and long, you know, and had that catch radius, that's relevant. Randy Moss, if he was 5'11 and didn't have that size and length and freakish leaping ability, he wouldn't be the same guy. He would still be an amazing receiver, but it would be different. So I think you can definitely lean on that stuff when you have a player that you want to push over the edge. But if you've got an amazing receiver who can get open, who can separate, who's got excellent leaping ability and route running and understands how to track the ball in the air, then it doesn't matter if he's 6 foot, 190.
You have a quarterback looking for a receiver in this draft, and Cam Newton has some inaccuracy issues. Would you be looking for a guy to wipe out those inaccuracy issues with a big frame, long arms like Kelvin Benjamin?
Yeah, I don't know if you can change accuracy issues just with the receiver that you're pairing with the quarterback. I think a guy, maybe there are going to be individual plays here or there where just a freakish ability at receiver is going to offset it. But if you've got a fundamentally inaccurate quarterback that has got poor ball placement, that's going to be a problem no matter who you're throwing to. So I think the Panthers were in a tough spot with Cam Newton because that is who he was for his entire career. You know, outside of that one crazy season in 2015, Cam Newton was a fundamentally inaccurate quarterback relative to other passers. But he was capable of amazing plays. Like, he had some of the best passes you'll ever see. His highlight reel is amazing, even independent of what he does running the ball. And the Panthers throughout his career cycled through like three or four different ways of trying to build an offense around Cam Newton and make the inaccuracy thing not a problem. Number one was they did what you're talking about. They got a whole bunch of big receivers and said, all right, let's grab a whole bunch of guys that Cam Newton just can't overthrow because they're so big. Then they tried to change the offense and made, let's throw everything underneath where the percentages are higher, where the throws are easier, and it'll be easier for him to have a higher completion percentage. But that just took away all the big plays that Cam Newton is really good at and kind of offset a lot of the inaccuracies. So, and then they had, you know, another offense where they kind of ran the whole thing through Christian McCaffrey. They tried a bunch of different things, but I think ultimately if you've got a quarterback like that, you have to just accept this is the negative of his game. Let's lean into the positives and try and offset them with that. So this was one attempt at trying to offset the weakness of Cam Newton, but I don't know that it was a smart one.
Benjamin, not great in the speed and agility metrics here, but the Bills end up going a few directions. And I think you guys made a really interesting comparison before Josh Allen broke out, comparing his accuracy issues at the time, but upside and arm to Cam Newton. But it seemed like the Bills kind of handled his inaccuracy issues at that stage of his career different than the kind of personnel they paired him with.
Well, Josh Allen, I think, is one of the few players that has fundamentally changed his traits, like who he is. He's not the same player now that he used to be when they drafted him or in his first couple of years. I think a lot of that was done from a coaching fundamentals, you know, technique, mechanic standpoint. And I don't know how much of it was even Buffalo doing it as opposed to, you know, Josh Allen's personal trainers and personal quarterback coaches, like him essentially taking it upon himself with his own private coaching team to work on his techniques and his fundamentals and his mechanics of throwing the ball, because he did completely transform himself. Like, Josh Allen now is just not the same player he was. And if he had stayed at that level of inaccuracy, then I think they would have had similar problems to Carolina with Cam Newton. And yeah, it looked like they were approaching it in a different way. And what I think is probably the best way in terms of, let's just get him a good player to work with, right? Let's make everything around him as good as possible and then accept that he's going to be less accurate than other quarterbacks, but offset it with some big plays. But as it turned out, it wasn't really relevant because Allen just fundamentally changed who he was.
Bills here trade up from 9-4 for Sammy Watkins. In the PFF live blog, they noted it's quite a risk to trade a future first rounder. Meanwhile, there's a stacked middle first round here in 2014 coming after the beginning of Clowney, Robinson, Bortles, Watkins. Do you think if this draft was rerun, knowing what we know in general, but not about the specific player outcomes, that some of these middle round first rounders could have cracked this top four here?
Probably not. I think generally speaking, so the first problem with this draft is there's no quarterback that anyone wanted to take, you know, at the top. And that always changed. Like, immediately when that happens, the draft is going to be a strange one because, you know, look at this draft, 2024, we're talking about quarterbacks potentially going 1, 2, and 3. Whenever that's not the case, whenever there's not a quarterback that anyone wants to take number one overall, either it's a bad quarterback class or simply the team picking in the top one or two already has their guy that they drafted a year ago or, you know, whatever, it changes the whole dynamic. And now you've got to start asking yourself, okay, which one of these guys that are not normally the top overall pick of the draft is worth taking at number one? And I think when that happens, teams tend to default to either edge rusher or offensive tackle for some reason. I've never fully understood why. I think they are two of the more important positions, but I've never quite understood why you can't construct a similar case for edge, for cornerback or wide receiver in addition to edge rusher and tackle. But anyway, so Jadeveon Clowney coming out at that point was seen as this incredible physical freak, you know, one of the most talented pass rushers to come along for a long time. Maybe now, given what we understand in terms of some athletic measurables and some thresholds and things like that, there would be more red flags about Clowney if we were doing this over, even without knowing what he became in the NFL. But I still think if you look at this draft, Clowney is probably the guy that goes number one again. Maybe Khalil Mack can do enough to force his way into that conversation. But I think the fact that he did it in Buffalo and the Mack is probably enough to keep him away from that. Offensive tackle would be the next one. So Greg Robinson, with his athleticism, I think would still be probably the top guy. Maybe Jake Matthews is a closer argument than that. Maybe even Taylor Lewan. But I still think ultimately this probably goes Clowney, Greg Robinson. You know, Sammy Watkins was aggressive and it took that trade to happen. And then Blake Bortles being the first quarterback off the board to a very quarterback needy team. Again, you look at the quarterbacks in this draft class and it was kind of, you got to take one of them. And it's Blake Bortles was the guy. Like the next quarterback off the board was Johnny Manziel. And obviously like that had more than enough red flags to scare plenty of teams away. Then it was Teddy Bridgewater. And at no point was anybody saying, you know, Teddy Bridgewater should go in the top four picks. So I think it probably would have unfolded pretty much the same with maybe, you know, a change or two, but at the same positions.
The Manziel discourse that week must have been interesting. I mean, his draft stock seemed to shift a lot that offseason.
You know, I don't know if you've seen that Netflix documentary on Manziel, but Manziel was such an intriguing prospect because for him to do what he did, given how little effort he put into it, as evidenced by that documentary, you know, he watched no tape, he did no work, he was constantly, you know, doing other things, drinking, you know, partying, whatever. For him to have had that kind of career, it shows you what ridiculous levels of talent he had. And as much as, you know, the whole draft process is about trying to uncover things about people. If the guy is able to keep it together for just a few months, you can fool somebody. You can fool a team into thinking that, all right, he's got all this talent and he's able to keep it together. We can do this. And that's ultimately what happened. Like enough teams passed on him, right? It's not like everybody bought into it, but all it took was one team to look at him and say, the talent is ridiculous. And, you know, he's keeping it together now. Like he's turned a corner, or now that he understands what's on the line, he's able to keep it professional. And, you know, if you talk to him and you buy into what he says, like it's doable to still fool teams. So, you know, I understand why he went in the first round. I think the talent was so incredible that for a quarterback needy team, particularly low in the first round, it's kind of worth rolling the dice. But equally, when you watch that documentary and you see exactly what was happening, it was never going to work.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you would do if you had an extra hour in your day? Go for a run, take a nap, hang out with friends, read a book. So many options. A lot of us spend our lives wishing we had more time. The best way to squeeze some more into your schedule is to know what's important to you and make that a priority. Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. I began therapy in early 2023 and I found it has helped me set boundaries, learn positive coping skills, and add a lot to my day to day. And some of that being prioritization to be able to focus on what is important at that time rather than trying to focus on everything that is going on in my life at that exact moment, which leads you to not be in the moment because you're thinking about stuff that is out of your control. And having that awareness has helped me throughout my day today. And that is something that I have found to be very positive for me. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/rotoviz today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/rotoviz.
You mentioned Bortles goes earlier. QB evaluation, has that changed a lot over the 10 years since, you know, Caleb Williams decided need to participate in the combine. How much does the combine play into it now compared to 10 years ago?
I think it's changed, but I feel like quarterback evaluation is still everybody just chasing our tails, trying to find out, you know, what actually matters, what moves the needle, how much to weigh everything. And I feel like the constant changing landscape in the NFL in terms of who pans out and who doesn't, it constantly leads you to sort of swing back in the opposite direction. So there was a period where sort of toolsy quarterbacks, guys with big arms, you know, physical stature, all those kinds of things just didn't work out for a while. And everybody was chasing them because theoretically the upside of those guys, the potential, the ceiling is crazy. And then there was a run. And so there was a long time of everybody saying, look, let's just find good football players, forget the giant, you know, physical outliers that haven't panned out for a while. And then we went on a run where the opposite was true. And all of these toolsy guys were working out, you know, Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes, like all the guys with crazy arm talent and crazy physical gifts were suddenly the ones that were working out. And now you're sort of going, well, does that mean we should start chasing those guys? Like, has something shifted in the NFL where you can now develop toolsy quarterbacks and actually get the most out of them? Or have we just gone on a run of these guys working out? So I think quarterback evaluation is still the hardest position in the NFL to get right. It still has a terrible hit rate, generally speaking. The combine is just another piece of the puzzle. So I think it is relevant sort of watching these guys throw one after another. You can see the difference in arms. And that is relevant information, right? Whether or not it's defining information is completely different. But if you have a Josh Allen arm, if you have Patrick Mahomes' arm, it lets you make plays that other guys can't make. And that makes a difference. Those guys have a bigger margin for error. They're capable of doing more things. When the chips are down, when, you know, things are going wrong, they can make spectacular things happen. Now, you've also got guys like Joe Burrow and, you know, Tua Tagovailoa, guys that don't have that kind of physical ability. They can still play at an incredibly high level in the NFL as well. But it does serve as a tiebreaker, and it is a difference maker. And lining them all up one after the other and seeing who has that arm, who doesn't, I think is relevant information. But it's a small piece, you know, and I try and think of some of these things like a kind of pie chart, you know, how much of the pie belongs for each sort of data point or each piece of information we have. And you've got tape, you've got personality, you've got physical tools, arm strength, all these kinds of things. That's a small piece, but it is a piece.
At receiver, have your views on what is disqualifying or what should be bigger parts of the pie changed over the years? At this combine, you have Devontae Adams. The contrast here between his 40, which is like 28th percentile, but 10-yard split, which is 67th percentile. You have Jarvis Landry. He ends up running a better pro day, I think, but I think it was like a 4.77 40 at this combine. How have your views on weighting the elements of receiver position evolved?
I think the last few years have changed my opinion on what disqualifying size is. You know, a few years ago, when Devontae Smith came into the NFL weighing like 166 pounds and coming out of Alabama weighing 166 pounds. So sometimes you'll get a guy coming out of a small school and you're like, okay, they probably don't have an amazing weight program, right? They don't have a professional sort of nutritionist and strength and conditioning guy and blah, blah, blah. We get him into the NFL, we can pack 15 pounds of muscle on this guy just by putting him in that professional environment, in the weight room every day, all those kinds of things. When you're coming out of Alabama's program and you're at that weight, that's the weight you are. You are already maxed out. They are not leaving meat on the bone if they think there's 15 more pounds to be packed onto your frame. So when Devontae Smith came out at that size, it was a huge concern for everybody. You're like, I don't know if that works in the NFL, but it does. Devontae Smith's still a really good receiver. Tank Dell came out last year at the same kind of size, like 160 pounds. Suddenly we've got this proliferation of tiny wide receivers that I think in the past wouldn't have been able to survive at that kind of level in the NFL. And now if you're able to play wide receiver, you're able to play regardless of the size. I think they're protected well enough by the rules. There's ways of NFL teams getting them free releases so they're not just physically overwhelmed at the line of scrimmage anymore. Maybe they can't be number one, you know, true superstar X receivers, but they can be really useful parts of a receiving core.
Brandon Cooks still has the short shuttle record from this combine at 3.81 seconds. If he'd been drafted in the later teens, do you think Cooks would have had an even better career statistically or as far as accolades?
Cooks has always been a good receiver. I mean, you can see in the workout numbers, there are reasons why he's always been productive and he's been an instant plug and play upgrade for every offense he's ever been in. Cooks is a little bit like Amari Cooper, where for some reason NFL teams tire of him very quickly and want to move on from him. But if you look at, he's been traded for, I think, a first round pick multiple times and has always been productive regardless of the offense he's been plugged into. And I think part of it is the speed, the change of direction of ability. He's got legitimate high end NFL receiving talent.
I was shocked just in research for this episode to learn that Brandon Cooks had never made a Pro Bowl. Like the best receiver you could think of to have never made a Pro Bowl?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he's been a really high-level player. His career is strange. He never made a Pro Bowl. A constant stream of 1,000-yard seasons, impactful seasons, multiple teams, traded multiple times for high sort of leverage draft picks. And good basically everywhere he's been. It is a very unusual and strange career. I mean, he's almost at 10,000 career receiving yards, and every single team seems to tire of him after like a couple of seasons.
Yeah, very good player, very good career. Chase Stewart, the football perspective, did like height and weight adjusted combine metrics, and Jerick McKinnon went off this combine. The running back position by then had been moving to where it currently is in the market, but what kind of hopes did you have for the kind of impact he could have?
Yeah, Jerick McKinnon was one of those guys who had the crazy bench press number, was one of those sort of stories of that combine week. Jerick McKinnon goes in there, puts up a ridiculous number for his size. I mean, he's an undersized running back, let alone the bigger positions that you expect to put out monster numbers on the bench. And so he was a fun player, like this tank, stocky guy with incredible strength out of a small school. And you're right. Like, I think at that point, the running back market was correcting. It was maybe the start of this push to sort of devalue the running back position, but it wasn't, I don't think anybody really knew. The analytics wasn't pushing it yet. The analytics hadn't gotten there yet. I don't think anybody really, you hadn't heard those sort of running backs don't matter mantras issued at that point. This was just a draft where it wasn't seen as a particularly good running back draft. Like, we didn't have a ton of guys that were top tier running back talent. So you had guys like McKinnon coming out of small schools that were some of the top drafted running backs that year. Bishop Sankey, from Washington, like this was not, I think he was the top draft or top running back drafted that year in the second round. Kind of like this year's running back class, 2024, where the league generally is down on it. Like, you only have to look at the running back deals getting done at free agency and how weirdly hot the market has been relative to this running backs don't matter devaluing of the position. I think to see how much the league does not like the 2024 running back class, and that's kind of what it was in 2014 as well.
Yeah, Bishop Sankey, first running back off the board. I think in that Chase Stewart study, Sankey was number 10 out of, I think, 268 combine participants as far as his height, weight adjusted performance. Aaron Donald, number one with a bullet. One guy in that list, that top 10, that has his own truther nation, Jeff Janis, number five there. Were you bullish on him? Some ended up being.
No, I was not. I didn't have big expectations of Jeff Janis. I don't think, being perfectly honest, I don't think I made it as far as Jeff Janis's tape when we got to in that particular draft. So, well, seventh round pick out of a small school. I don't think I ever, I mean, you see the numbers and that obviously makes you intrigued, but I had no opinion on Jeff Janis when it came to draft time.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk. But it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Players that have like great combine results but don't jump off the screen as far as college tape or measure of their college production. Was your view on them more bearish than it is now, or how is your mind on that dichotomy?
Well, I think one of the things that's changed between 2014 and now is access to tape, at least in terms of guys like PFF. We have our own inbuilt video player that all the teams have and are connected to now. So if there's a player like Jeff Janis, right, who shows up at the combine, has crazy numbers, and you hadn't watched him yet, forget the NFL teams, but just in terms of NFL analysts or, you know, somebody talking about these players, if you don't really know who that is because he hadn't jumped out in terms of grades or production or whatever, you can go and fire up his tape, you know, immediately with a couple of clicks of a button and go watch him. So that I think is a different thing. Back in 2014, before all this existed, a guy shows up and puts up insane numbers at the combine and you're not a big college football fan, like, you have no earthly idea who that is. And maybe you might find a clip here or there, like a highlight reel, but you have very little ability to go and watch him after the fact. And he became almost like a just sort of abstract concept, right? A guy who's got these numbers and these measurables. We like that as a throwaway seventh round pick because what the hell? It's upside, right? He's got these numbers, so let's go for it. Now you can actually go and cross-reference that and check it and have a look at the tape and, you know, figure out if there's a reason this incredible athlete isn't a particularly highly ranked prospect or not.
Taking a look at the players who ended up on the PFF 100 end of year 2014, who are rookies, coming in at 93, Chris Borland, nothing spectacular at the combine, but was he someone at PFF had an eye on early?
Chris Borland, I think, is one of the great what ifs of the last 10 years. He looked like becoming one of the best linebackers in the NFL immediately, and obviously walked away from the game, retired, was maybe the only guy still to have walked away like right at the start of his career for fears of head injuries, right? CTE, concussions, all those kinds of things. But San Francisco was on this incredible run of linebackers where they had Patrick Willis and then Navarro Bowman. They had Takeo Spikes at one point as well that they brought in obviously as a veteran as opposed to drafting him. And then they draft Chris Borland. Like, they were just knocking it out of the park one after another with these Hall of Fame caliber linebackers. And Chris Borland looked like he was going to be the next guy, undersized, like wasn't the sort of same height, weight, size, speed freak that Patrick Willis was, this prototypical linebacker, but looked like an incredible player, just had a nose for the ball, instincts off the charts, and then walked away from the game really early. How long did he play? Was it two seasons, or did he even only make it the one?
Seemed to be taking the mantle, but only for a short bit. Coming in at 47 on the PFF end of year list, rookie Joel Bitonio. Really good three cone, really good 40. Not a great bench press for interior linemen, but do those stats matter for you? When I guess he came in as a tackle, but moved to interior lineman, but the draft stock of an offensive lineman.
Yeah, I don't think bench press matters a whole lot for offensive players. I mean, you know, Orlando Brown Jr. had one of the worst combine workouts of all time, and he's been a good player at the NFL level. You know, maybe if a guy has a truly terrible workout, certainly the agility measures are more relevant, I think, than than the bench press. The bench press is just not a particularly strong metric, I think. It's all correlated with arm length, in a negative way. So the NFL wants to see long-armed offensive linemen, but long arms makes it harder to bench press. So in a way, it's almost measuring the exact opposite of what you're actually trying to achieve in terms of other things. So it's not a great, it's a legacy workout, you know, that's just there because at one point they thought it was a great example of strength. Now it's just not, it's not really fit for purpose, but we run it every year. And sure, sometimes it's interesting where a guy shows up unusually well or unusually badly. And you're like, that's a little weird, but you can't really judge offensive linemen by what they're putting up in the bench. So, you know, Bitonio is a guy who was always a really good pass blocker in the NFL. He's had years where his run blocking has been spectacular as well. In those years, he's been arguably the best guard in football. But basically from day one, he was a top-tier pass blocker for the Browns.
The three players ahead of them on this list, I've covered Khalil Mack, Aaron Donald, Odell Beckham, making immediate impacts their rookie year. I think I chatted briefly at the 2020 Combine. There's that great PFF show. I remember Peter King was on stage talking about how we were on the abyss of something with COVID, and everyone's like, oh, that got really real for a second. But I ended up going into isolation, just being glad we had that right before everything shut down. Has anything changed since that 2020?
I think now it's kind of back to normal. I think there was a while where, you know, things were different, protocols were different, all those kinds of things, obviously. But, the most events the kind of next year, I think most people, like the following Super Bowl, not many people went to that at all, I don't think, relative to normal years. I think the Combine was similar. It was a down year in terms of attendance. But after that, I think it kind of corrected itself. And I can't think of too many differences now from those kind of pre-COVID years. But yeah, that Combine, the world shut down like the next week or so. It was almost right at that point where people had heard of COVID. People sort of knew vaguely about it. There was this weird sort of awkwardness between everyone of like, you know, hey, are we supposed to fist bump now? Like what, you know, almost like a joke. And then like everyone departed that the Combine, everyone went home. And then like the next couple of weeks, the whole world just shut down. That was sort of the last, really significant anything where everyone was around, everyone was like this, thinking back on it, this like absolute ridiculous, like super spreader event was taking place. And then almost immediately everyone gets quarantined and, work from home and all those kinds of things for months.
I did a podcast there with Charles McDonald, now on the Yahoo Sports, at the time New York Daily News, but I remember tweeting like a week later, is like, I feel like I have something that's like full blown COVID. I was like, oh crap, I think I do too. And but heading into there is like, I think the general assumption was it wasn't here yet or it might never come here. How has the media setup changed since 2014 and through 2020 and 2020? And how has the media congregation changed?
Yeah, it's changed venues a little bit. It's moved around within the convention center into different places. The last few years, it's been fairly static in the one sort of area. There's a big media workroom that's just a few lines of tables, and they stick food out there as well. And then there's the kind of Radio Row area, which is obviously a lot louder. And then Radio Row kind of backs onto the podium area where all the players go and coaches and all that kind of thing. The last year, this year, they seem to have shrunk it down again. It seemed that it was ever expanding and just getting bigger and bigger over the last decade. And then this year, it seemed to be noticeably condensed, and Radio Row was smaller than usual. The actual space, normally there's that sort of like a significant enough walk between Radio Row and the podiums. Now it was like they butted onto each other, so it was right next to each other. I think the entire floor plan of the room that they were using, I use room in sort of general terms because I don't know what you call those things. They are colossal indoor convention space, convention center spaces. But I think they use like half the actual square footage than they normally use. There's like a partition that isn't normally there. I don't know if that was, that convention center hosts a whole bunch of things, and even during Combine week, like there's always something else going on. at the same time, there's always like truck week following on. So I don't know if they just had an unusual volume of conventions or whatever happening this year, and so the NFL got half the space they normally get, or if there is some reason that they've deliberately shrunk down the amount of media on Radio Row and during the combine week. I guess we'll find out next year. But you know, generally it's a week. It's maybe the most productive week, I guess, in terms of reconnecting with everyone you know in the media circles, because most of the people are there at the Super Bowl, but the Super Bowl is generally in a city that's so big that you don't always, you know, everyone's in different places. It's actually connecting with everybody is difficult. Whereas in Indy, it's so small, everybody is at the same sort of three or four places, you know, after the work is done, you know, whether it's at the JW, whether it's at one of the steakhouses, and you kind of see almost everybody from the media world in the NFL over the course of a week.
This has been another episode of Remember That Game. Please rate, review, subscribe, and check out more episodes.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.